From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes, the executive editor of the Weekly Standard Magazine. Joining me on the show this week are Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Oren Durell, Foreign Affairs Reporter for USA Today. And here are the issues. Donald Trump, the Republican presidential nominee, met with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto in Mexico City for an hour. But in a speech in Phoenix, he took a hard line on immigration, saying anyone who entered the U.S. unlawfully would be, quote, subject to deportation, unquote. Hillary Clinton, meanwhile, the Democratic presidential candidate, was urged by the New York Times to cut any ties to the Clinton Foundation if she is elected president. And in Brussels, the European Commission ruled that Apple must pay $14.5 billion in new taxes because Ireland had not taxed the American company sufficiently. Well, as usual, we're going to start with the presidential race. Donald Trump is always making news. This trip to Mexico City was remarkable in many, many ways. And afterwards, Donald Trump had been talking about softening his position on immigration. Then hours after his visit to Mexico City, he gives a speech, and he doesn't soften his position at all, quite the contrary. Linda, let's start with Mexican President Nieto and Donald Trump. What about that meeting? What do you make of it?
Well, it was a very interesting gambit on both of their parts. President Peña Nieto had invited Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, I should add, to come see him in Mexico City. I'm not sure he expected either of them to take him up on the offer, but Donald Trump sure did. Apparently, we learned about this at the last minute, but apparently this was a long time in the works because the Trump campaign knows it's in trouble and needed to do something dramatic on this issue of illegal immigrants and what the damage that has done with Hispanic voters, whom Trump is losing quite badly. So the two met, and then they had a public little press conference in which Donald Trump looked very presidential. I mean, he was sober and, you know, not inflammatory. They didn't yell at each other. And it seemed, I think, to actually do Donald Trump some good to show that he can be presidential, that he can meet with a world leader and, you know, have a certain bearing on the world stage. And then, of course, he goes to Phoenix and undoes it all.
Oren?
Well, this is an interesting meeting. I think that a lot of people were kind of wondering why the Mexican president invited Donald Trump to begin with. His poll numbers are very poor. He's polling in his disapproval rating of something like 25% approve of him.
And this is the Mexican president.
The Mexican president, Mr. Nieto. And after the meeting, his approval rating was even lower. He was widely panned by Mexicans for inviting Trump. The Reforma newspaper said that you know, he was used by Donald Trump, and there's been a couple of weeks of Donald Trump trying to sort of soften, talking about softening his immigration stance, softening the laws to, you know, help immigrants living in this country, talking about, you know, he'd said that there'll be no amnesty, but that he'll work with people who are living in this country who are peaceful. But then at the speech, he, you know, he talked about, again, about building the wall, and he added something about that Mexico is going to pay for the wall to his speech, which hadn't been in the speech earlier. Apparently, they had an agreement, Mr. Trump and the Mexican president had an agreement not to talk about the wall, but the Mexican president tweeted before the speech that he actually told Trump that he's not going to pay for the wall. And because of
which
that,
which was not a surprise. I mean, the Mexicans have said that all along.
I guess after Trump's speech, people basically are saying that he doubled down on his original posture regarding immigration, hardline posture regarding immigration.
I thought that was a fair comment. I have followed the immigration issue for a long time, and I don't think anybody, Linda, could have expected him to say, Donald Trump to say, well, I'm not going to build a wall, or I'm going to now agree to a path to citizenship for illegal immigrants in the United States. I don't think they could have expected that. On the other hand, what I really thought he might do, because he had hinted at it specifically beforehand, was to say that, well, illegal immigrants in the United States who want to stay in the U.S. legally, not seeking citizenship, but just stay in the U.S. legally, legally, which means they wouldn't, you know, face a daily threat of deportation, that he could find a way for that to happen. Well, he said just the opposite. I mean, it was really a very tough speech. And most of the speech, this is the speech, except for the one thing you mentioned that was added, Orrin, was one he was always going to give.
Right.
You know, it wasn't a new, I mean, he had a text beforehand. I guess I'm just still surprised at the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's trying to achieve the impossible, which is to hold on to his base, mm-hmm. the people who love the wall and who respond to that.
But they're not going to abandon him anyway, I don't think.
I don't know. I mean, do you think, obviously they don't vote for Hillary Clinton, but do they stay home? So he's trying to hold on to those people and maintain their enthusiasm mm-hmm. while also reaching out to other segments of the electorate that are currently not with him, but perhaps gettable, perhaps, say, suburban white Republican women who might like his message on security and on safety, but just aren't sure about his approach to immigrants and to minorities. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just not possible. I mean, he really does have to soften his tone, but I think he really can't help himself, which is why he added that line back.
Well, okay. Orrin, do you have any more to say on this, or we'll turn to Hillary Clinton?
You know, going back to President Enrique Peña Nieto of Mexico, you know, the images of the two men standing next to each other was really kind of striking, you know, in part because the Mexican president had compared Trump to Mussolini and to Hitler, his rhetoric to Mussolini and to Hitler. He had called his positions in the past populist and demagogic. And, you know, it makes you wonder what this is, how this is going to affect him politically in Mexico.
Well, he's not very popular. As you said, you know, the visit by Trump was not unprecedented. And I guess we don't know yet whether Hillary Clinton is going to go and talk to the Mexican president. But Ronald Reagan, after he was elected in 1980, did visit Mexico and talk to the Mexican president then. But nothing really came out of it. Reagan didn't come back and give a fiery speech after that. It was quite different. Well, anyway, let's turn to Hillary Clinton, who continues to have trouble. I think there's widespread agreement that she's ahead. Polls show she's ahead anywhere from, you know, 1 or 2% to 7 or 8%. And we're going to be getting, after Labor Day, which is on Monday, a slew of polls, the ones that are the most respected polls, the ones that are done jointly by big newspapers and TV stations. And then there's the Fox News poll and the CNN poll. There are about 5 or 6 of them. And we know now that Hillary Clinton has lost some ground, which was expected. You gain a lot after your convention, and then you lose some. But she has had other troubles. And I was struck by this New York Times editorial. The New York Times is a paper that has certainly been favorable toward Hillary Clinton. They may have already endorsed her, I'm not sure, but if they haven't, they will. And said she needs to cut her ties and should do it right away with the Clinton Foundation, which is, you know, the problems with the foundation. It was, anyway, I'll let you unravel it all, Linda.
Well, this is an issue, both the Family Foundation and the email situation. This issue is going to follow us through Election Day and beyond, if she's elected. And even if she's not elected, I think we're going to be hearing about Hillary Clinton's emails and the Clinton Foundation forever. I mean, what's striking to me is that she hasn't cut her ties already on her own. I mean, she has to know. This is just a huge blind spot for her. She's got so much going for her in so many other ways, especially against Donald Trump. And to allow this to continue is just shocking to me, but here it is. And we continue to get more and more information about, you know, through email traffic, the favors that are asked. And while it doesn't necessarily rise to the level of criminality, or at least something that that a Democratic administration is going to prosecute, but it is certainly something that just reinforces the very low number she has for trustworthiness and honesty. And that's what keeps Donald Trump competitive in November.
Orrin, here's what the New York Times said. This is the last sentence in its editorial of some days ago. It said, achieving true distance from the foundation is not only necessary to ensure its effectiveness, meaning the foundation's, it is an ethical imperative for Mrs. Clinton. I mean, the Times in this editorial leaned over backwards and saying nice things about her and about the foundation, but wound up saying it's an ethical imperative that she cut her ties to the now very controversial Clinton Foundation.
The way I see it, the damage is done already, whether she cuts the ties now or not. The emails, the latest tranche of emails that have been exposed, show that, you know, that Bill Clinton paid for a private server and other IT equipment from the foundation, paid for this private server, that email server that Hillary Clinton used to send all these emails, were bought for by the foundation with taxpayer money that was used, that was supposed to keep, you know, from a fund that's supposed to keep former presidents from going broke. You know, now the FBI has, you know, found 14,000, you know, almost 15,000 new emails on her server that are going to be released in the next few weeks or months. And again, these latest emails show all these favors that were being asked for by Clinton Foundation executives on behalf of the, you know, Crown Prince of Bahrain, on the behalf of a sports marketing executive who was trying to get a meeting for some football star who's got a criminal record against him in the British embassy. I mean, all kinds of strange favors that are being...
Here's what I don't understand. Why does Hillary Clinton, who may be on the verge of becoming president, cling to the foundation?
Well, it is her husband's foundation.
Well, that may be the best explanation.
And I don't see, frankly, how she can completely cut her ties to the foundation. I mean, she's still married to Bill Clinton. Chelsea Clinton is still her daughter. It's the family foundation. And I think, I agree. I think it's too late. I think that this is already kind of baked into who she is and her public image, and cutting ties or not, this is this is just part of who she is.
I think the other element of this is that...
Oren, let me stop you, and I'm going to come right back to you, but we're going to have to take a break here. First, let me remind listeners, this is Issues in the News, coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me today are Oren Durell of USA Today, who I just interrupted, and Linda Fellman of the Christian Science Monitor. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast, if you're so inclined. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/archive/issues-in-the-news. All right, Oren, back to you.
I think that another element of this is that the foundation grew to a $2 billion foundation through donors. And Hillary Clinton needs these donors for her presidential campaign as well. And she's going to be turning to a lot of the same people who helped build the foundation. I don't know exactly how it works in terms of whether she needs to cut the ties, whether she can retain contact with those donors while cutting ties to the foundation. But there is a link there for her campaign.
You know, here's what I want to ask a couple things about the Clinton campaign. She's the favorite. I think there's a guy who examines all the polls. His name is Nate Silver, who has a great record of predictions. And he gives Mrs. Clinton something like a 70% chance of winning the presidency. I have no reason to disagree with that. And yet, her campaign just can't seem to leave Donald Trump in a trail of dust. And they've adopted this strategy recently of so-called running out the clock. In other words, Mrs. Clinton wouldn't do much. She just sort of, you know, she'd go to fundraisers and give a few speeches, but not be as active every day, front and center, the way Donald Trump is. You know, I thought that was working for her for many, many weeks. But now, Linda, I'm not so sure. I mean, we see Donald Trump getting closer.
That's right. But I think the closeness of the numbers, first of all, the national numbers are less important than the numbers in battleground states. So there's just a handful of states, because of the Electoral College, that really count. And in those states, Clinton is either ahead by a substantial amount or it's close. But Donald Trump has to win those states. He can't. So I think I think Nate Silver has the odds more like 80% that Hillary is going to win this. And the reason why I think on a national basis the numbers are so close is because of the polarized nature of the electorate. Most Republicans are going to vote for Donald Trump, not because they all love him, some do and some don't, but because he is the Republican nominee and he's the only game in town if you do not want Hillary Clinton to be president. And the same holds true for Hillary Clinton and her supporters. Now, she has people who vote Democratic are more with her than Republicans are with Donald Trump. So I think in the end, that's that's why she wins. But it is going to be closer in a way than it should be, given the fact that Donald Trump is an amateur politician and is kind of making it up as he goes along and is learning on the fly how to do this and is having incredible success, but probably not enough to win.
Well, he's had a few bumps in the road, too. You know, I like the way you describe the campaign. I mean, it's odd that it looks at this point, as we get into September, how much it looks like the way the two candidates are, their positions, how much it looks like 2012 when Mitt Romney was running against President Obama, who was running for re-election. And most of the states, as Linda said, if you're Republican and live in a Republican state, or live anywhere, you're probably going to vote for Donald Trump. And polls show that he's ahead in almost all the states Romney won. And then there are the three states he has to win in order to win the presidency, and those are Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Florida. And he's behind in all of them. And in Pennsylvania, which he'd have to win, he's way behind. And yet, there he is, hanging on, and he's gotten closer in the last couple weeks to Hillary Clinton, Warren.
One of the things that I think we all have to remember is that Donald Trump has been underestimated in the past. And he's very good, as we've seen the last couple of weeks with this whole Mexico trip that we started with, at getting headlines. He's very good at getting attention, and he's very good at manipulating the media to, A, to cover him, and B, to try to guess at what his intentions actually are, what his policies actually are. And he sends mixed signals, then he doubles down on towards his base. I think all of this, I mean, I saw one of the headlines that I saw was about the Hillary Clinton campaign saying that they're not really sure which Trump they're going to meet at a debate, right? So I think this campaign is very unpredictable. We've not seen anything like it before, and it's a little risky to make a prediction.
You know, there was a writer for National Review magazine, a conservative magazine, who wrote a piece about how Hillary Clinton is surely going to win this election, absent an unforeseen development. The whole success of Donald Trump so far is an unforeseen development. I mean, that's and who knows what might happen now. I agree with you, Linda. That's going to be very hard for him to win. But you know, he seems to be the master of unforeseen developments.
Absolutely, but I would argue that in the media now, we're hearing a lot of argument for, well, maybe Trump can win this. We've underestimated him the whole time. But winning the nomination is different from winning the whole thing. I mean, if you look at the numbers of people who vote in primaries, it's maybe, 30 million people versus the entire electorate, which is many times that.
120 million
120,
or something
130.
Like that.
So, and and some people think that now the media are overestimating Trump's chances to make up for the fact that they didn't see Trump coming during the primaries. So, I don't know. But exactly. But I'm not, nothing is 100% for sure. Yeah.
Well, nothing's 100%. And one way this campaign is different, it used to be that they always said, well, the public's not paying any attention to this election until after Labor Day. Well, I think, Orrin, they've been paying attention to it for a number of months now, once Donald Trump locked up the nomination, and that was early May, so, three or four months ago.
People have certainly been paying attention.
And we'll continue to. Well, I think we've exhausted where that race stands, and who knows what Donald Trump will do. But, I kind of expect Hillary Clinton to start campaigning a bit more actively now. She does have a great war chest, and so she can air a lot of more ads than Donald Trump can. But, candidates have to campaign, and I think we'll see more of her. Anyway, we have the European Commission, Linda, trying to dun Apple to pay $14.5 billion in taxes to Ireland because they say Ireland undertaxed them. This strikes me. I can see now why people in the United Kingdom voted to get out of the European Union.
No, this is an extraordinary story. Underpaying taxes for more than a decade. So you have the European Commission telling Apple to pay Ireland. Ireland doesn't want the money. Because it sets a bad precedent. Mm-hmm. Ireland likes being a tax haven. They have low taxes in Ireland, and you have a lot of corporations, a lot of overseas corporations, basing themselves there for that very reason. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, you have the U.S. government, they want that money. So, you know, the Obama administration is extraordinarily frustrated by the $2 trillion in U.S. corporate assets that are sitting overseas that it can't get its hands on. Mm-hmm. So you have these multiple vectors going of, you know, big piles of money and various actors trying to get their hands on it. And in the middle of it is Apple. But it, this could expand also to McDonald's and other multinational corporations based in America who are trying, I mean, all companies try to pay as low tax as possible. Mm-hmm. So everybody's doing what's in their own interests. Mm-hmm. But this, as you say, it really just brings home why the UK did vote for Brexit. This idea that somebody in Brussels can tell Ireland how much tax to demand from Apple is just amazing.
Ireland does have a low corporate tax rate. I think it's 12.5% compared to the one in the U.S., which is 35%. What do you make of this whole fight over Apple and taxes, Oren?
Well, on the one hand, I can see the European Commission's point, because they're supposed to be policing this economic union, the European Economic Union, to make sure that everybody is competing fairly. And yet the Ireland is calling this a matter of sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this is one of the, I think, one of the key issues of sovereignty versus union that the European Union is facing right now. Mm-hmm. The U.S. Treasury, you know, said that this this ruling jeopardizes the spirit of economic partnership between the United States and the EU. So the U.S. Treasury is completely against it. Senator Chuck Schumer called it a cheap money grab by the EU. You know, Apple.
Well, it's not very cheap. It's 14 and a half.
It's an expensive money grab.
Yeah.
Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, denied that there was any kind of special deal with Ireland and called this an attempt to rewrite Apple's history in Europe and ignore Ireland's tax laws and upend the international tax system. He called the back taxes idea unfair. There is a possibility, you mentioned that the United States wants this this money. Apple has something like $215 billion stashed overseas, and it has talked about bringing this, repatriating this money, bringing it back to the States. But it wants a deal with the Americans on how much taxes it would pay on that.
You know, there's an easy way to get the money back, and that's if you adopted Ireland's corporate tax rate.
Right. So the EU made a statement. The Commission made a statement that the ruling might be affected by whether or not Apple pays taxes somewhere on that money. Mm-hmm. So there might be some kind of a, I don't know for sure, but there might be some kind of a deal where the Apple pays the taxes in the United States and the EU backs off.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see. There's always a deal to be made but, in things like this, but I don't know. I mean, certainly Apple, which has one advantage in the U.S., not only being such a prosperous company, but it's a very popular company. I mean, people, look to these new products that are put out by Apple. And so a decision by the EU is one that it's certainly not going to be popular with Apple, but isn't going to be popular with the American people either, I think, Linda.
No, I think you're right. And I think it's the European Commission is really playing with fire on this. Mm-hmm. I mean, even if, there are rules. And I think what Oren described with, you know, this out that's there, if Apple would pay some tax on it in the United States, that would make it go away. That could solve the problem. And I keep thinking of how a President Trump would handle this. I mean, to me, this is the classic situation where you have, where you need a deal.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
the deal man can come in and sort of, you've got leverage on various sides and sort of solve this and also put a little more in the U.S. Treasury coffers.
All right. That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief of the Christian Science Monitor, and Oren Durrell, Foreign Affairs Reporter for USA Today. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Wagner Roberts and Linus Rimkus. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.